This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We record in the offices of Raider Solutions, which offers a complete fleet of IT solutions for businesses of all sizes. Raider's motto is, "You just want it to work, we understand." If you're wondering if Raider can help your business, please visit RaiderSolutions.com. I'd like to also thank IberiaBank for its support of Discover Lafayette. Founded in 1887, IberiaBank is the largest bank based in Louisiana and is headquartered right here in Lafayette with 325 combined locations throughout the South. They offer the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit IberiaBank.com for more information. Our guest today is Lafayette native Jim Gosson, president of the board of the Gulf Seafood Foundation. Jim is an industry leader for the recovery and improved sustainability of the Gulf of Mexico's seafood industry. His career in the restaurant, seafood processing, manufacturing, and distribution business began in 1972 when he began selling Gulf seafood out of a pickup. This was the genesis of the business that would turn into Louisiana Foods, a global seafood purveyor that he sold to Sysco in 2012, and where he served as chair of the board until his recent retirement. Jim is a recipient of the Environmental Protection Agency's Gulf Guardian Award, My Tables, Legends of the Industry, Southern Living's Heroes of the New South Awards, and is one of Cooking Light's 20 Food Heroes in America. Today, we get to learn about the importance of the Gulf seafood industry and how important it is to our culture and lifestyle. Jim, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
So nice to be here and being in Lafayette.
I know. So, little disclaimer, we are neighbors. You also live in Houston.
Right.
But we live right by the oil center, and it's kind of a block for Gosson. So
Yeah, I have a brother. In fact, I bought my dad's house after he died from the family, and I'm spending more time here now that I'm semi-retired, and of course, I've been in Houston 40-something years.
Right.
Since I moved there in 75.
So. Yeah. You've got a fascinating history, and it did all start right here, though. You graduated from USL.
Yes, for you in 1971, and I was working in and out of Morgan City, and I was asked by some of the Landrys to go check on a restaurant that was up for lease in Morgan City. And I had no intention to get back into I'd worked in high school and college at Don Seafood downtown and really didn't have the intention to go into the restaurant business. And went and looked at the building. It was $750 a month back then.
Oh, gosh.
And Don Landry said, well, if you come and work with you could have stock. Well, that changed everything.
Oh, yeah. Maybe you'd be interested in the restaurant business.
Right. So that I got into that. And I moved to Morgan City. I think I was 23. And then by the time we opened, I'd just turned 24. And moved to Houston in 1975.
Yeah. And let's back up from there, because I want to get you to talk a little bit. When you started, and the reason I mentioned in the intro about the pickup truck, you were actually delivering. You were picking up, buying and picking up and delivering Gulf seafood, right? To make sure there was high quality.
We were buying basically two things, shrimp and red snapper. Mm-hmm. And we would sell to ourselves. We had a little company we called Creole Foods. And we would sell to some of the other Dons and just pick it up at the dock and go run it to the restaurant. And
so you would go twice a week, though. I mean, you were really a road warrior.
Yeah,
at that point.
Mean, and when we started that, we didn't have any intention. It was basically to buy and to buy a little better price and to be able to go pick out what we wanted on the dock. And of course, when we moved to Houston, we realized to be able to get that. And other things, we changed the name from Creole Foods to Louisiana Foods because people didn't know what Creole meant pretty much.
Right.
And
so you brought Louisiana seafood then when you moved to Houston. I mean, you were really bringing in Louisiana seafood.
We were bringing all. In fact, we were the first people to do crawfish in Houston and boil crawfish and etouffee and all that. We also brought community coffee there. It wasn't there then. we were picking up Leidenheimer French bread. I bought a tractor trailer truck in 1978, and I was driving it myself twice a week, back and forth from New Orleans and down to the mouth of the river, picking up oysters, Barks Root Beer when Barks owned it.
Camellia beans.
Camellia red beans. Mm-hmm. And Leidenheimer French bread. And then, of course, as Andouille sausage, mm-hmm. we'd go to the Veyrons down in, I guess, Gramercy, down in that area, pick up Andouille sausage. None of that was available in Houston at the time.
So you were driving the
I was driving the
truck, trailer.
Yeah. My mother used to say, why do you want to do that? I said, because I can't get anybody else to do it.
Right,
you know?
Right. I can relate to
and
that.
And really it was building a business where I had to have the relationship mm-hmm. with the people we were buying from.
Right.
And, it was basically, I didn't know what I was doing. So I had to kind of learn my way. Mm-hmm. And by being on the truck and looking at what I was buying, and of course I made relationships with people mm-hmm. because you're the guy buying it and you're the guy selling it. So
So you were partners with the Landrys?
Yeah, I was partners with Bill Landry and mm-hmm. Floyd Landry when we first opened up. Floyd's still in the restaurant business and has Floyd's in around Houston. Billy unfortunately died of cancer. And then we had some other partners in some other restaurants, mm-hmm. but...
I was reading Magnolia Bar and Grill, Jimmy G's,
Willie
Landry,
G's.
And Willie G's,
We really, when we opened the restaurants, we really had, probably if I'd do it again, I'd have had just one name, mm-hmm. but looking back on it, but we didn't want to have it to where we had a chain of where we had to do everything the same. Each one we wanted to have a little...
Right.
I still have one restaurant left, Jimmy G's, near the airport in Houston, and a catering company, which
in Houston,
called Louisiana Catering, which mm-hmm. we do a lot of oil related catering.
Right, right. Well, can you talk about the growth of your company, Louisiana Foods, because that's really, from what I understand, the crux. That was your big business, and how did that evolve over the years? Because you were from here, but based in Houston. You, like I said earlier, you were really supplying Louisiana seafood to Texas.
We were supplying to Texas. In fact, some of our, what we did, I try to fill up the tractor trailer truck to pay for the freight, mm-hmm. And try to sell to some other my friends in Houston. And in 1980, I don't know, late 80s, we sold Landry's and Willie G's to Tillman Fertitta, which now is Landry's. Mm-hmm. And so I spent most of my time at that part trying to build Louisiana Foods. Mm-hmm. And, of course, started with three trucks, and I think we had like 50-something when we sold.
Right,
It was just like... not knowing the business, just being in it and being involved in mm-hmm. it and learning it, being on the trucks, mm-hmm. being a salesman.
So you've seen
being
all
the collector, being everything.
Right. You've seen the industry change, though, because back then, I know in the 80s, there weren't limits, right? The industry has changed dramatically.
They had, they didn't have limits, and they probably didn't have the demand for seafood as they do today. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go to any steakhouse, they have a crab cake. They didn't have that back then, and they have... items that when I first started, I had 9 items that I sold, basically, catfish, frog legs, shrimp, crab mm-hmm. meat, speckled trout, flounder, catfish. And if I would have tried to sell salmon, they'd have run me out of Houston.
Really?
Well, it just wasn't available.
Okay.
I was one of the first people to bring in Norwegian salmon to Houston, probably to Texas. Uh-huh. And
to the cowboys. They were cowboys.
Well,
steak, huh?
they just didn't eat. Mm-hmm. Salmon was not available. I mean, wild salmon was not marketed outside of the Northwest. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when the Norwegians started producing farm-raised salmon, we started selling it. Now, probably salmon's our company's number one selling fish in volume.
Wow.
Because it's available, mm-hmm. it's farm-raised, it's consistent. You can put it on a menu, and you'll know the price is going to be pretty consistent, mm-hmm. and you're going to have it every day.
Yeah.
And it's a perceived high quality fish,
mm-hmm. you know,
perceived
healthy.
By the healthy.
Right.
But you know, halibut, we couldn't fly anything back then. The airlines didn't want anything that could leak on the plane and mess up any other freight that they had. So we had to go in, you know, over the years.
So it was regional in nature.
Yeah, I mean, if we couldn't get it on a truck, we didn't get it, you know, pretty much in that time. Now we can get fish from all over the world. You know, you can get fish from Australia within a couple of days of being out of the water. So it's completely changed.
Right.
And people are used to eating all types of seafood. I mean, people didn't eat squid here. People didn't eat octopus here, you know, when I grew up.
Some of us still don't.
Yeah, but if it was not catfish or speckled trout or flounder, that was it. They didn't eat it, you know. And but the tastes have changed. The chefs became more competitive with each other and trying to bring in different items and different. And if you brought you know, any kind of new product, that they were willing to try it, and if the consumer bought it, that was great. You had to keep buying it.
Now, before we started taping the podcast, you brought up something interesting, and it brought back memories of delicious dishes that I probably haven't had in a long time. You were talking about speckled trout and how some of the fish that were we would always eat in the past, now they're only available to I guess, recreational fishermen.
Right.
Has that impacted your business?
Well, I think it's impacted the industry greatly where, you know, a guy that has a dock that buys fish, every time you take something away from him, you're taking gross revenue away from him. And as you take the revenue away from him, you take his profits away. So if he can't, you know, he would maybe run crabs over his dock. He was getting speckled trout over his dock. He was getting redfish over his dock. They make so much a pound. Basically, they'll get it, they'll ice it down, then you'll buy it from them and go pick it up. Well, back in oh God, I don't remember the year. I guess it was in the 80s. They I guess concerned that they were overfishing. The commercial fisheries are overfishing speckled trout and redfish. After Paul Prudhomme, he took an underutilized species that really no one ate. I think we sold 1 million pounds total in the state of redfish.
Black and redfish.
But he went. He did a black and redfish more to help an underutilized species, and no one could have imagined that it'd take off and went worldwide. And then everybody wanted redfish, so there was no control over it. And so all of a sudden they said, we got to stop commercial fish and trout and redfish, and it's just going to be recreational.
I remember that, yeah.
And, you know, which they should have, in retrospect, taken it and said, okay, we're going to allow this much to be harvested for the consumer that doesn't fish. And but they had to have management. And
but they just shut it down.
They just shut it down, and the lobby was bigger on the recreational side than the commercial fishermen. And
well, I remember that. I used to lobby back then. It was that was big news. They were all over.
And the commercial fishermen, it's all, most of the businesses on the Gulf Coast are mom and pop businesses. There are no big industrial, like the Northeast and the Northwest and Alaska. There's no big operations. It's the husband's fishing and the wife is running the business. And let me tell you, if the wife didn't like you, you didn't get fish.
Really?
If you didn't pay your bill or you didn't do, you know, because she really ran the business.
And she knew.
The husband was out there normally doing, and you know, everybody, most of the shrimp boats are family owned. They'd come into the dock, they sell their and we never really bought, when you start getting into selling seafood like we did, we needed all different sizes of shrimp, we needed it packed a certain way, and so we bought from the processing plants, and they had everything, either you buy peel shrimp or head-on shrimp or certain size, certain counts, and and that's what the consumer would buy.
What's been interesting for me getting to know your story, Jim, is that over the years, you've become known for your conservation efforts, for your stewardship of the industry. And from what you're saying here, this is I don't know how many there are now, how many fishermen, especially in Louisiana, but these are small businessmen that are living pretty much off the land. And things have happened that have impacted their livelihoods. And I know you've been concerned about protecting and sustaining this industry, because a lot of them, collectively, they have a voice because of people like you, but individually, they probably don't know how to get the word out when they need help. And I know after the BP oil spill in particular, you established a foundation that was a precursor of the Gulf Seafood Foundation, because they were devastated by the oil spill.
Yeah, I mean, most of them are just trying to make a living.
Yeah.
They don't have time to go, and it's not like a company big enough to have a lobbyist and
maybe
representing you, because believe you me, if you don't have a lobbyist, you're not represented. You're the last person represented. And but we have more than just the industry. It's a culture of what we have down here in South Louisiana and the Gulf Coast. I mean, I used to run up and down from Naples to Brownsville on the Gulf Coast, and it's all the same. It's small family businesses that started. Their grandfather was in the business, and as it got further along, where they had more and more restrictions and more people fishing, you know, recreational fishermen is a big industry, and we really need to protect that industry because it involves tourism, boats, and all that. But they had a bigger lobby than the commercial. And I always thought, well, you know, we have to keep enough seafood for people to be able to eat if they just want to go buy it at a grocery store.
Like me, if I want to go.
Yeah, and then if you don't own a boat, you shouldn't be penalized if you want to eat red snapper. So that's been my, not to take away from anything from the recreational, that's a big industry and we need it.
I understand, yeah.
But we also, if I don't want to buy all my food from China.
Right.
And I know a lot of the commercial fishermen today are not really for aquaculture. And I'm involved a little bit with oyster aquaculture, which was an easier thing to start because there's nothing you can find negative about growing oysters.
In aquaculture, when you use that term, you're talking about farm raised, where it's controlled.
Well, we wouldn't be eating seafood today, pretty much, if it was not farm raised. We don't have enough shrimp in the Gulf to supply the demand worldwide. We don't have enough fish. We don't have any big processing plants other than shrimp, and I'm sure they hurt every year with less and less shrimp. With all that fresh water that came down the Mississippi, which there's really no way to prevent it. It's just happened. I mean, but what do we do about it now? Mm-hmm. And
it's impacted all of
it's impacted the crabbers, the shrimpers, the oyster people, and if we want to eat our own food, our own grown food, we have to think out of the box. We can't just keep continuing to do what we've been doing.
Right.
And whether it's going to be offshore aquaculture, we would not be eating salmon today if it wasn't aquaculture. Because if you go into a store and it's not your plate of wild salmon's not $40, you're not eating real wild salmon. It's just expensive. So I don't think it would hurt our fishery that we had aquaculture. It would just make it more valuable because the people that appreciate wild caught fish would be willing to pay more.
Right. So I know that you believe that, I know that most of the fishermen aren't paid much for a typical catch, but that I've read this anyway, Jim, if you can explain it, that as an industry, it would behoove them to market what they have and the importance of this local industry, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
it's tough to compete.
I've said that we can't compete on price. We have to compete on quality. So how do we focus on improving our quality of what we catch, whether it be less drag times in the Gulf, putting less sulfites on anything, and just treating a product like it's a premium product,
right,
and not trying to compete on price, because we'll never compete with China. Can just keep lowering the price, so we have to look at it differently. And also by growing our own seafood, mm-hmm, and helping the fishermen. I had a, I work with UL and Jeff's Dr. Stewart,
yeah,
on they're doing a study now, and I said, you know, I really thought that we needed to promote Gulf seafood, but I said we really need to promote American seafood, because then we can have more people chip in to help promote it, because we don't buy from shrimp from Bahia, Ecuador. We buy Ecuadorian shrimp. You know, we buy Indian shrimp. We buy Chinese shrimp. We're not saying where it's coming from, mm-hmm, and I don't think we have enough money to be able to promote every little area, Louisiana shrimp, Alabama shrimp, it's all Gulf shrimp. Mm-hmm. But maybe we need to rethink of how we promote our American-made products. Mm-hmm. And is it worth more money to buy American product that you know that has,
yeah,
certain restrictions on the fishing of it? Or, mm-hmm, or do you just want to buy the cheapest? And you'll always have both. People that want to pay premium, that's why you have prime meat and you have select.
Mm-hmm.
That people, that for the each market, it's not as great for prime, but you're getting a higher price,
right,
dollar for it.
But this is all important if we're going to sustain the industry, because if young people coming up, if they don't see that they can make a living being a fisherman, they're just not going to do it.
No,
you know,
right.
And I know that historically it's been, like you said, family passing it down.
Yeah,
but This is an issue.
Well, you know, passing like it down, a lot of them today, if their boat wasn't passed down from their father, mm-hmm, or grandfather, they couldn't afford to buy a boat and pay for it for what they catch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Dickie Brennan's group in New Orleans, and John Besh's group, and Donald Link's group, they see the value and not trying to see how much they can push the price down to the fishermen. So they go back to them, and like Ryan Pruitt runs Pesh, and one of the owners of Pesh in New Orleans, he sees the value of what do you need to make a living?
Mm-hmm.
Then it's up to me to sell it. And that's what I've been trying to do for years. You have to be able to sell it. If I can't sell it, then it doesn't do anybody any good. But I have to be able to get a product that I'm proud of and say, wow, buy this. But mm-hmm, it has to be able to get more money. Mm-hmm. And because if the fishermen don't make a living, nobody up the chain makes it. Then you're just selling the same thing,
yeah,
everybody else is.
You're losing the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you lose the culture. And so there's a new breed of fishermen. It's young people. And it's really our job as the old guys in the business to make sure they survive, or we won't have anything.
Mm-hmm. Does technology play a part in any of this?
Yeah, I mean, technology plays a part. It's like the old saying where you don't eat oysters in the R months. Well, that's because they had no refrigeration. Now, in the summertime, they have refrigerators on the boats. They have to be in a refrigerator within 1 hour of catch.
Or you can't consume them?
Or you can't ship them.
Oh,
so, okay. You know, so...
Yeah.
If they're put in a cooler within 1 hour, then they can get a tag that's able to ship. So the seafood is taken care of a lot better than it ever was.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more tests being done in the water. All these universities have these labs now that they're testing the water. And probably we have the safest seafood we ever had. It's just that we have a world demand, mm-hmm, for seafood. As these, I look at tilapia. I'm not a big tilapia fan. I don't eat it, but not that I wouldn't. It's just that China is a big, big producer of tilapia. Well, you would think that tilapia would go, the price would go down, but it keeps going up because the people in China are buying more.
Oh, okay.
So as the countries become more prosperous, the people will be able to buy their product, mm-hmm, and eventually may not be able to get anything from China or India because the people will be having more money, right, to buy their own product. So if we don't produce it here, you know, I've heard, we could buy everything from somewhere else. Not really, you know. Mm-hmm. You just never know what happens.
I know there was a law that was passed that said that seafood in Louisiana, it has to be labeled if it's foreign. Is that right? Like from China?
Well, shrimp.
Would you explain that?
Yeah, shrimp and crawfish. Mm-hmm. If in restaurants, if you sell crawfish that's imported, you have to specify that, or shrimp that's imported. You have to specify that on your menu. And I know a lot of people that was, you know, for it and against it. I mean, I think everyone should have the right to know what they're eating. And the problem exists is when you can't, let's say you use a 16, 20 count shrimp, and you can't get a Gulf 16, 20 count shrimp. And this is just from people giving me feedback, mm-hmm. you know, and they have to go to buy a shrimp from Ecuador, for instance. Then they, you know, that's when the, now I know that the health department's been going out finding people that are, and I really believe everybody should know whatever they're eating. Mm-hmm. I mean, you shouldn't be able to hide what you're eating.
Is that just in restaurants, Jim, or is it any seafood you purchase, like if I'm in Costco, let's say?
And, well, retail and restaurants are two different. If you mm-hmm. go into Costco or Rouse's or any mm-hmm. major, or any grocery store, you have to have, they call it cool country of origin label.
So it says it on the package. That's
by law. Uh-huh. And that's FDA mm-hmm. law. And
you have to look closely sometimes, though. I was trying to buy crawfish, I think it was last year, and it was called Boudreaux's or something, but it was Chinese. And I was at Champagne's, one of our local, you know, our
right.
our
and
neighbor
you would
grocery.
Think Boudreaux's, but
they said don't buy that. You know, there's local, and it costs more. But I bought it. I bought the one that was local.
Right.
But the name on the Chinese crawfish was some kind of Cajun name.
Well, and that's kind of misleading, you know. And it's amazing that the FDA lets them do that. But you know, the bottom line is, if people don't see a value difference, if it's not something that they noticeably mm-hmm. taste, you can't force people to spend more money.
Right.
So that's I go back to saying we have to produce a better product. When the Swedes came in and bought all our big crawfish years ago, they've taken out all the big ones. They started peeling or selling smaller crawfish. Well, you can't fool people. I mean, mm-hmm. and as I see, it's changing. But you know, the like crawfish meat in a pack, the Chinese sold it as 100 count, 80 count. Now we just sell it as a pack of Louisiana crawfish, mm-hmm. and just because you have a pound of crawfish, if it's the size of rice, you don't want to buy it.
No.
So I go back to like. Somebody like Frank Randall, mm-hmm. he peels bigger crawfish. When I want, and I'm in town, yeah. I want crawfish, I call Frank. But it costs more. Mm-hmm. You might be getting 20% yield, but a big crawfish, you're getting 14 or 12% mm-hmm. because they have big claws, big shells.
And having that whole experience.
Yeah, right.
That's what it's about.
It's just, it's whether, you know, it's like canned seafood. Normally, canned seafood, like you buy from Spain, is the highest quality sardines there are.
Really?
Yeah, they put the best one. If it's with olive oil, you can be sure it's a high quality sardine. But people in general think canned is not good. Mm-hmm. But let's say you had big crawfish tails and you put them in a can and you could go and open up and eat some fresh crawfish tails out of a can. It would be delicious, but we have to change the way we're marketing things mm-hmm. and get the most for the product rather than try to compete with mm-hmm. Chinese crawfish. I mean,
so you're active. I mean, I know you retired from Cisco as chair, right. But you're still very active.
When my wife
this.
Got sick, I retired, and probably that. I thank God every day that I was able to do that and spend the last year and a half with her, but. Yes, I'm very active. I really see that that without people advocating mm-hmm. for the fishermen, and we have a great group of people, and there's many organizations. We're just one of them, but you know, we're ready to tell the story if that story needs to be told. Mm-hmm. We were the ones that came out and got the lieutenant governor, and, mm-hmm. and we have several organizations to declare a national emergency for the seafood industry. That had never been done before, but we didn't know if the federal government would do it, but we knew that, hey, look, you do this for the farmer, what about our guys mm-hmm. that are, you know, they can't afford to lose a crop. They have, a lot of them have H-2B labor. They bring them in from Mexico, and then they go back to Mexico. They help peel the crawfish, mm-hmm. shuck the oysters. Well, they got to pay them whether they have product or not.
Right.
So somebody should be responsible, even though it's a man-made thing. It's a God, mm-hmm. you know, created act. But it's you know, you have flood insurance.
Right.
If your house floods, you get somebody. Right. You know, and that's why you have insurance. But the fishermen don't have any of that, and it's like they have such a small voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, individually.
That no one thinks of their problem. I mean, it's you know, mm-hmm. it's just that we just don't have the big companies to be able to.
Yeah.
And so that's why it takes guys like me and Frank and mm-hmm. you know, Harlan Pierce and Yule Smith and Eddie Childs and all this group of Father Oob. You know, we see the issues that these fishermen have. And we could tell, all we could do is tell the story and hope that somebody listens.
Right.
And that at least we can preserve the culture. Mm-hmm. Because the culture is all along the Gulf Coast, the fishermen. And once we lose that, I think we'll lose something.
We'll lose a lot.
Very special. You know, I mean, it's something that I don't want to live without.
Right. I don't either.
Yeah.
This past April, I was looking at went through some news stories, and that's when the freshwater was being flooded, you know, and affecting a lot of the wildlife. And they showed pictures of the dolphins and turtles, and the fresh water was causing them, you know, their eyes were affected, and it pitted their skin, and they perished. And those are the kind of things we saw too after the BP oil spill.
Right.
And I know that people thought about the fishermen, but not in the same way, I think, as they did to the wildlife. And what you're saying is very thought-provoking, you know?
Well, I mean, it's very important that they mm-hmm. see this, what's mm-hmm. going on. And, you know, it's like you're looking up at a bird on a wire, and it falls out and it dies. Well, you never see, you think that somebody shoots it, but things die. I mean, you know, fish die in the ocean. Mm-hmm. You just never see it.
Right.
And so it's not something that you would say, well, only when they float up ashore. But mm-hmm. most fish that die in the ocean, they're eaten by something else.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know.
Predators. Yeah,
yeah, predators.
Right.
I mean, uh-huh. that's just, that's
survival
that's,
of the.
That's how
fish.
It is.
Right.
You know, everything eats off of something else.
Right.
And, but if we want to have a seafood industry, we have to think out different than we did, that our grandparents mm-hmm. did. It was an abundance. We didn't have the demand we have today. Everybody has instant demand for everything they want. I've heard this young college person complaining that their microwaves were slow. I said, wow. You know,
yeah.
So things have changed. You know,
yeah.
We better speed up the microwaves.
Yeah. The microwave. Remember when we just didn't even...
Oh, well, I remember
nobody
our first
had that.
One. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I was saying,
a miracle.
Well, you know, we used to have to put that in the oven and wait, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Or just put it in the sink and water.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
That's funny.
But yeah, the microwave was too slow to heat
yeah.
up their milk.
Well, I have a couple of questions I want to get you to discuss. So I know that one of the things you've been lauded for is working with chefs to use the bycatch, like when fishermen are out in the water, they catch other fish and other seafood as they're pulling their nets in. And there used to be, I guess, a lot of waste, because you said that those fish, they don't survive. If they've been caught, you can't really release them and have them, you know, surviving
yeah.
in many cases. So this has actually worked out pretty well, though, right?
Well, I think it made people aware mm-hmm. that we have so many wonderful fish in the ocean that no one eats because they never had to.
Yeah, didn't know about it.
Well, there's no reason to when you could get all the speckled trout you wanted, or all the redfish you wanted, or all the snapper you wanted. I mean, we have so much fish that we never had to target. And then, of course, there was no fishery for, let's say, at one time you were catching snapper and you catch a trigger fish or a triple tail, all these different fish where you might catch 200 pounds of it. Well, it's not enough to market it. It's not like you have, you know, red snapper. My company bought 1/5 of the whole Gulf quota for red snapper, which that's not a lot of quota. I have, you know, for one company to be able to purchase 1 million pounds of the 5.5 million at the time. So we don't have a lot of fish out there where a company can say, well, we have all this wild fish. So it was very important. Well, if this is edible and this is, you know, there's a lot of delicious fish that cobia and all these different fish that no one really had ever had to eat.
But I've seen these on menus, and it gave me pause because I didn't know what cobia was or triggerfish, you know.
And it's really up to the restaurant
to prepare it properly.
And to get the feedback from the consumer and say, well, you know, we can't sell it. It's, you know, it's either, you know, it's a strong taste or whatever. But there is a market for everything. When you travel the world, you see that the different people in different parts of the country eat every part of the fish.
Right.
We're the only ones that take the fillets and throw the rest away.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. Yeah.
You know, I remember years ago in Morgan City, we had we'd get our catfish and we'd fillet it, and we would take the bones and lay it in a pot and stack them up and steam them, and then take the bones out and all the meat. And it was the best tasting fish. We'd call it a fish stew, you know, but we would feed the employees with that.
And they were eating like
kings. We were trying to use everything, and some of the people would cut the tails off and fry them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's using everything. Mm-hmm. And my whole thought was that if your stomach's full and you only ate a portion of this other type of stuff, but you ate all this, it's putting less pressure on the other parts of the seafood.
Well, I have a question also, shifting gears a little bit, about oysters. I know I read some articles. You were working with a fellow that was thinking about getting out of the industry. And I know there was a study done that people like oysters to be a certain size, like the average person. Can you talk about that? You know.
Yeah, this was about 7-8 years ago. Oyster fisherman Jules Melançon, he was a fourth generation oysterman, and he, right before the BP spill, he said, you know, I just don't see the volume of oysters. He had about a 70-foot steel hull oyster boat, and it took a crew of three and you know, $300 worth of fuel a day to run it, and he said, you know, I'm not making any money. I just don't see the volume of oysters that my grandfather had and my dad. So I took him to see Bill Walton in Alabama. They had one farm, which it's called AOC, Alternative Oyster Culture. And it's basically taking a seed oyster that's grown in a lab and putting it out in the wild in a cage, whether it be floating or on the bottom, and growing it out to the size that the chefs want. Mm-hmm. When I grew up, people ate a 4-inch oyster or they didn't eat it. They didn't want a small oyster. But now the tastes have changed, and you have a lot of women that are eating oysters that probably didn't eat them years ago, because the oyster bar, they'd go into a restaurant, the man would stand at the oyster bar, and the family would go sit down and order. But now you have a lot of ladies eating oysters, and they want a smaller oyster, which by law, you can't sell a wild oyster that's less than 3 inches.
Oh.
You know, it has to be at least 3 inches. And personally, I like a bigger oyster, so.
That's what you grew up with.
I grew up
and
with that.
And you ate raw oysters.
I eat raw oysters. I love them, and I like a bigger oyster. But the general market today is not wanting that. I mean, yes, maybe you go to the old-fashioned oyster bars. Yes, you go to Abbeville and they'll want, you can't serve the little oysters, but in general the upper scale restaurants, upper And they're wanting it for two reasons. That's what the consumer wants, and they want them to order something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if they're eating some big 4-inch oysters,
that's all they want.
That's all they can eat.
Yeah.
You know, so, and so I told Jules, I said, you know, get into that, and if you want to, I'll help you, and I'll sell the oysters for you. And
so it's oyster farming.
It's oyster farming. Uh-huh. In cages, and he's out there today. In fact, I talked uh-huh. to him this morning.
Where is he doing that? Is it
in Grand Isle?
Grand Isle, okay.
And he's using a couple of reefs, historic reefs that his grandparents had. His grandfather had it's called Independence Island. They had two camps there, one for to eat in and one for the men to sleep. I think they had about 17 men, mm-hmm. and they tonged with tongs. And they would send 1,000 sacks every other day to New Orleans from there. Now, no oysters grow there wild anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can put them there and they'll grow, but they won't take. And all the things that have changed because of levees and mm-hmm. what have you. So all our estuaries are different today. And that's one of the good things about oyster aquaculture. You can move these cages wherever your water quality is the best.
Mm-hmm.
And
you just lease the water space?
Yeah, you get a lease and permits from the Wildlife and Fisheries and also from the Corps of Engineers. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that's one of the things about aquaculture. You can control it, I think, better mm-hmm. than just wild fish.
Right, right. It's interesting. Well, some of these awards you got, Jim, I understand now. I mean, you have been a guardian of the industry, and you've been recognized by so many different groups, whether it's magazines or government agencies. Where do you see, how do you see things evolving over the next 5 to 10 years? Do you anticipate more big changes in your industry?
I think we're going to see changes, and I'm really hoping it's for the best. All change takes time, and you have to see, a young person has to see they can make profit. Today, they're not looking for big profits. They're looking to feed their family and raise their kids, and mm-hmm. and that's what they're happy with. And if it, but they have to make enough to where they can pay their house notes, and they can send their kids to school. And it's up to people like myself and the wholesalers and the big seafood companies. If we want it, we've got to help them survive. We can't just say, well, you're too much, your cost too much. Well, if they go out of business, we're going to be selling something from China, and which I don't have any problem. If a consumer wants that, mm-hmm. fine. But I wouldn't want it.
It's a
personally.
Loss. Yeah.
It's a loss. It's something that doesn't have to be, but we're all in it together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not them against us, or, you know, it's not the wholesaler against the fisherman. You know, if we all make it, I remember Dickie Brennan doing he did a little wine and oyster taster, and he brought Jules there, and mm-hmm. I went, and it was from the farm to the table, and really, this is who we ought to celebrate, this fisherman. He's just like the guy that's growing great crops. And mm-hmm. Because without him, and if we don't help him survive, we can't be looking at, well, the Chinese or the Indians are selling for this much. You got to compete. Well, he can't. He can't compete. He's got insurance. He's got all mm-hmm. the things that we have to do in this country
that they don't
have to do there.
Right.
So if we want him, and people come to New Orleans or Lafayette, they don't come here to eat halibut or sole. You know, they come to eat local seafood.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a sad day, and I'll never see that, but that they won't have it. But I always know the right people to go to,
yeah.
you know. But,
right, but for the
but
rest of us.
It's getting harder right. and harder for the average consumer to mm-hmm. find good, fresh seafood.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I remember my grandmother, I was a young kid. They had Hardy's Fish Market on, I don't know, one of those piers or one of them. And every Friday, you know, every Thursday, she'd go get her fish that they'd cook on Friday.
Mm.
they don't have a lot of places like that anymore.
No, no. Yeah, we were talking about a local, you said it was L&L.
Yeah.
On Carmel Drive, right off of Pin
Hook. Yeah, my brother Kevin loves to go there, you know.
And that's a Vietnamese fisherman who's worked hard and purchased his own boat or boats at this point. But he's worked very hard to go fishing and have his store
open. I
mean,
thank God for the Vietnamese that they settled here and in Houston and the Gulf Coast, because really they have been a big part of the success that continue on with our seafood industry. They didn't mind working, and their whole family didn't mind
working.
As their children are educated, you know, things change. It's just like every culture that comes in here, the first generation does a lot of labor, and then their children, as they're educated, you can't blame them. They don't want to live on a boat.
Right.
But, you know, where the next generations of fishermen come from, I'm hoping it's the younger people that see an opportunity, but we have to go help them. As old guys in the business, we have to be the guy to be their advocate.
Yeah, for policy initiatives. That's right.
And to make sure that they're getting the money that they need to make a living, because I've seen, you know, I guess the only advantage of getting old is you can see the past, and you know, it's things that you thought would always be there, not there anymore. I mean, and they used to have oyster boats lined up in Grand Isle. They don't have any anymore. None. I mean,
right. If people want to read more about this, where would you send them? To the Gulf Seafood Foundation page?
Where we have the Gulf Seafood News, Ed Lalo.
He's got great photography.
He is great. Well, he was, Ed worked for People Magazine for 20 years.
His photography traveled is all outstanding.
Over the, he is. And we're really lucky to have him. He was, when the, after the BP spill, the Louisiana Seafood Promotion Board hired him to do stories. And we were able to get him on the board and come with us. And he understands.
Yeah.
And he, you know, it's not something I got to explain to him. He knows. And he can write an article in depth and really knows what he's coming from. And that's how we got him to do the article on, let's get all these organizations together and call for a state of emergency for the fishermen. And through his story and through his gathering all these different other agencies, we were able to get that. And I think it's the first time ever that the government has declared a state of emergency and put money for it.
Right, right. Well, then Gulf Seafood News, and if you just Google Jim Gossin, so many stories that are interrelated come up. So again, thank you for what you've done to work for our seafood industry and for Louisiana's culture. I know it's more than Louisiana, but here we are.
Yeah, I mean, we're in Louisiana and all, but, you know, when I look back, what a great career I've had with these wonderful, I mean, I met some of the most incredible people. I mean, real salt of the earth people, and they don't ask for anything. They just want to survive.
Right.
And, you know, we have a great group of people that see the issues. It's just whether we can help them move to the next level and the next generation see a future out of it.
That's right. Well, speaking of great people, I don't want to sound trite, but we are here with my hero, Jason Sikora, who tapes our show here at Raider Solutions. And you've been making a lot of notes.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up Gulf Seafood News. And I'm glad that you're here to tell your story. But have you ever considered writing a book?
I don't know if I want to sit down and do anything, you know, today. It's just like, I've had a lot of people want to write a book. I've been lucky to be able to travel around, meet a lot of great people in this industry, which is a unique people. You know, in the seafood industry, a little different. It's more of a independent, very, very independent people. But I've learned some great little places to eat from them, too.
Oh, wow, that would be a great book. You and Ed could do that.
Yeah, Ed would
be a great book.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah.
All right, so the podcast is called Discover Lafayette, and it's all about Acadiana. Where's some of the great places to go to get local, fresh seafood? And I'm being selfish asking this for myself.
Well, I mean, I know that Delcom Direct has done a really great job of bringing fishermen to have a place that they can market their seafood for the consumer. Mm-hmm. Now, restaurants, it's very hard for them. But as you as a consumer,
yeah.
They have, Granger Seafood. I think they pronounce the name Granger. In Maurice, it's a great little. Her husband's a shrimper.
Oh, really?
She's got and we did a story at Gulf Seafood News. I took Ed there. Did a story on her.
Oh, wow!
When can we go there? Like that's not a bad drive.
Yeah, it's right there, right past the
like
Maurice.
Like any day.
On the right. Yeah, every day. I have her her number. She used to come to the farmers market, and she's terrific. It's people that are taking their product and trying to get more money for it, that are taking care of a better care. Like she'll peel the shrimp, she could buy. The other places like that, it's just like Catfish. I go to Berwick and buy it at a little place when I'm on my way to Grand Isle. Pick up wild catfish. There's nothing better than wild catfish. Somebody was saying, wow, this is really good. I said, this is what they try to make the farm taste like.
Yeah.
And not that farm is bad, but wild is just, it's a special thing.
Yeah, definitely. Good. I'm going to take those notes. You talked a bit about the FDA. Are there any rules that you think that they should put in place that aren't in place already?
As long as there's management, running a plant and all that, the FDA pretty much come inspect you, and you have to have all your paperwork, and you have, I think our biggest issues are how do we manage what we have, and how to, have accurate data coming from our fisheries. It's always been, our wildlife and fisheries does a great job here, but all their money has to come from licenses.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get any money from the state. So it has to be self-funding from the industry, from the fishing licenses, from the, they do a great job. It's something that, because we don't see, we seem to neglect, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I always say, if you could see all the fish and you saw something declining, would you be cutting the roots of your money tree if you had a money tree? Even if it was doing $10 bills instead of $100, would you cut it? Would you?
I do love that quote you've said before. It's the money tree beneath the sea.
Yeah, it's a money tree. Because what else do we have that is really a renewable resource?
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of renewable resource. The shrimp always come back. The fish always come back. It's like, really, but what else can that really always comes back except the blackberries, maybe?
Yeah.
Every year in April.
Yeah.
But, we have that. We have to think about what can we do to help it come back even more.
Mm.
And I don't think we really focused on that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I want to put a plug in for the little video that we do, because I don't think we really mentioned that. Definitely go to the website and watch the video. Because the question today was, what's your favorite dish? And I thought the answer was great.
It was.
Definitely watch the video. But you also, my very first question I had, and I'm glad you brought up tilapia, because I don't eat tilapia much either, and you said that you didn't. But is there any seafood that you just flat out avoid, that you just don't like?
No, it's really... I like a lot of sushi and sashimi and I love that. Good fresh seafood, it shouldn't taste fishy. Tilapia is not a bad fish.
I call
it the chicken of the sea.
Yep.
Basically, it's a fish that's affordable.
It
that
is,
everyone
yeah.
could eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very bland taste. There's no specific, it'll take on whatever you do to it. Great white meat.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know of any seafood that I don't eat.
I had a feeling that was going to be your answer, which is why I asked.
No, I guess if...
Anchovies.
I love anchovies.
Tuna.
My family.
I love tuna. I like canned sardines. In fact, I ate... is famous. I forgot the name of the brand, but they're famous for olive oil. Well, in Galicia, Spain, they can these certain sardines with their olive oil.
Oh, and that's good for you, too. It's
yeah,
calcium.
So, you yeah. know, I guess if it's, I don't like liver. You know, so I'm not going to eat the fish liver, so I don't eat
Fair enough.
Pork liver or beef liver, you know.
Fish liver.
Or fish eyes. No, but they have people that eat everything. You go to every other country. We're the only country that takes the breast out of a duck and throws the rest away.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess because we have an abundance of everything, but every part is good to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You know.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you for being here today. This has been fascinating. I'm glad you were able to tell your story.
Well, I appreciate having me, and I hope I get to come back soon.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And Jim, thank you.
We'll talk about restaurants next.
Okay. Yeah, perfect.
Because I'll drive 150 miles to eat something if somebody tells me about it.
Well, and I know your friend Frank Randall and Randall's Restaurant. They always have high quality.
Yeah,
so.
He does. He, you know, he picks his own crab meat. He picks his own crawfish, and he goes picking up a lot of times himself in his own truck, still doing it at my age, doing that mm-hmm. because he loves it.
Yeah.
You know.
And he takes pride in
fine
product.
Yeah, oh, he does.
Yeah. Well, Jim Gosson, again, thank you for sharing your love and also your work in sustaining the Gulf seafood industry. It's been a pleasure having you here. So thank you for joining us, and thanks to Chris Rader for introducing us.
Well,
you know.
And thank you so much. It's you know, Lafayette, it just, you know, grew up here, and it's such a wonderful, wonderful people in town, and there's nothing like when I come home here. It's always going to be home, even though I've lived in Houston 45 years.
Yeah, it's the best.
It's coming home.
We're very lucky. And thanks to our listeners of Discover Lafayette. Really grateful for your support. You can find this interview and all of our interviews at the website, discoverlafayette.net, or you can go on your phone and subscribe. Just get a podcast app, and you can look up Discover Lafayette. It'll be delivered to your phone every Friday, so we encourage you to do that. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, I'm Jan Swift.